Good evening, everybody. My name is Leslie Gable-Brett, and I'm the Director of Education and Public Affairs at Lambda Legal. Thanks so much for joining us on this members-only teleconference about DOMA, marriage equality, and relationship recognition. It's really an exciting evening for us to be talking because not only are we on the heels of a huge victory in our case challenging DOMA, and we'll hear more about that later, but moments ago, the Maryland Senate approved their marriage equality bill by a vote of 25-22, and so that bill is now on its way to the governor of Maryland, and we have a lot of progress there, so we'll hear more about that later in the call. Let me tell you, please, about the two attorneys that are speaking on the call tonight, and then a little bit about how we're going to proceed. On the call, we have Tara Borelli, who is a staff attorney based in our Western Region office in Los Angeles. Tara was our lead counsel in Galinsky versus U.S. Office of Personnel Management, the lawsuit I was talking about challenging the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and we just had a big victory on that yesterday, so we'll hear more about that. Tara also coordinates Lambda Legal's work on healthcare fairness, and she happens to be our lead counsel in a case in federal court on behalf of Arizona State employees who temporarily lost their health insurance coverage for their partners until Tara temporarily got them back. That case is ongoing. Tara also has advocated on behalf of LGBT and allied students in California, Oregon, and Washington who have faced bullying and harassment, unlawful restrictions on their gay-straight alliance activities, and unconstitutional limitations on their right to be openly gay in school. Also on the call is our Marriage Project Director, Attorney Camilla Taylor. Camilla is based in Lambda Legal's Midwest Region office in Chicago. Camilla was our lead counsel in the historic marriage equality case in Iowa, which struck down Iowa's marriage ban in April of 2009, making Iowa the third state in the country at that time to permit gay and lesbian couples to marry, and the first, and so far only, in the heartland of our country. Camilla is currently handling many cases, two new cases in Iowa where the state's Department of Public Health there has refused to respect the parental status of same-sex couples in issuing birth and death certificates. She won one important round in one of the cases there, but sadly has just filed another case because the same Department of Public Health in Iowa erased the name of one of the mothers on a fetal death certificate for their child who was stillborn. I think Camilla will probably tell us a little bit about that. Camilla also has a full docket of cases throughout the region and is one of our lead experts on parents-child relationships and many other matters. So tonight, because we had a very big win yesterday, we're going to start with Tara, who will tell us a little bit more about that case and what the decision means. After that, Camilla is going to give us an overview of the marriage equality and relationship recognition activities around the country, and then we will answer your questions, some that have been submitted in advance, and others you can send in during the call if you wish, to libertycircle@lambdalegal.org. That's libertycircle with no punctuation, libertycircle@lambdalegal.org. And please put the DOMA in the subject line so we'll know that you're writing in for this call. I will say that we'll do our best to answer your questions, but if we don't seem to get to yours, we'll try to get back to you offline. And also, we will not be answering very specific or personal questions about individual legal situations, as I'm sure we will all agree that it's not a good idea to dispense legal advice on a conference call. So before I call on Tara to get us started, let me just add a quick thank you to all of you who are members and friends of Lambda Legal, which is everybody on this call. We're real proud of the work we do, but we couldn't do it without your support. And when we win in court, it's really a victory we all share. So thanks so much to everyone. With that introduction, Tara, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Leslie, and I want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. It is so exciting to be speaking with all of you. The one-year anniversary of the historic letter that Attorney General Eric Holder sent to Congress, and also to be speaking with you, as Leslie mentioned, just one day after a federal trial judge in our DOMA challenge, Galinsky versus OPM, ruled that DOMA is unconstitutional. So as a number of you will remember, 1 year ago today, Eric Holder's letter to Congress explained that the federal administration had concluded that heightened constitutional scrutiny should apply to discrimination based on sexual orientation. And that letter also took the position that under this standard, the government simply couldn't defend DOMA. And it was just especially gratifying to see Judge White in our DOMA challenge adopt similar reasoning in his decision yesterday. But before I talk about that decision, I'm going to give a quick overview of the major pending DOMA challenges, since there are a number of them to keep track of, and then share some thoughts about the ruling in our DOMA case yesterday. So first, let me say, I'm not going to try to describe every single DOMA challenge out there, since these cases have been mushrooming at times, or it feels like it. But I am going to describe some of the main challenges to watch that I think are likely to help shape the landscape as DOMA continues to work its way through the courts. I should also note that I'm using a bit of shorthand in this call. There are two sections of DOMA. One that says that the federal government can refuse to recognize marriages of same-sex couples, and one that says that states don't have to recognize valid marriages of same-sex couples from other states. The litigation that I'm going to be talking about in our DOMA case generally all focuses on the section that has to do with the federal government refusing to recognize these marriages. So that's going to be the piece of DOMA that I'm talking about as we move through the conversation today. So I believe that the very first challenge that was filed to DOMA was Gill versus OPM, or the Office of Personnel Management. And that was filed by our sister organization, the Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders in Massachusetts. And that's been particularly fitting because same-sex couples have been burying each other there for the longest period of time. And those couples have faced challenges to a denial of a wide range of federal benefits. We know that there are well over 1,000 statutes that reference marital status for spouses. And so it's really the breadth of this law in terms of its denial of rights and responsibilities for same-sex couples is incredibly significant. And the couples in that case represent a myriad of different kinds of harms, including those relating to spousal health insurance, Social Security, and a series of other harms. That case is now pending in the First Circuit, where the briefing is complete, and they are waiting the scheduling of oral arguments. The First Circuit is a pretty quick-moving court, so in comparison to some other circuits which have larger caseloads, I think that we can expect the First Circuit to move fairly expeditiously. We were very privileged to file an amicus brief in that case recently, along with our sister groups at the ACLU and the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and that brief expounded on the subject, of course, very near and dear to our heart, the reasons that we believe that heightened constitutional scrutiny is the appropriate level of review for governmental discrimination. This question, which has not yet been decided by the United States Supreme Court, remains an open one, and obviously it would be particularly exciting if the First Circuit engaged that analysis and reached what we think is the right conclusion on that question. There is a companion case on appeal with Gill, and that case is called Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. It's a case that was filed by the Attorney General of Massachusetts, and I think it's incredibly powerful to have a state in court presenting complementary arguments under the 10th Amendment about state sovereignty. And stories about the inexcusable ways that DOMA not only discriminates directly against gay people, but that the ways that DOMA coerces and forces states to discriminate against their own citizens. So, for example, federal government has informed the Commonwealth that federal government is entitled to recapture potentially millions of dollars if the Commonwealth allows same-sex spouses to be buried next to each other in a veterans cemetery. So again, I think it's incredibly important and a significant development to have a state presenting these arguments, and that in tandem with the arguments that will be presented in Gill on behalf of those plaintiff couples should make for a very strong presentation to the First Circuit. Next, I want to describe a couple of other cases that are on a parallel track with our Belinsky case. These cases have proceeded in parallel fashion, and in fact, all three cases were actually fairly closely coordinated. And these include first Peterson versus OPM. This is another case filed by GLAAD in Connecticut, representing married couples in Connecticut, in New Hampshire, and Vermont. And second, Windsor versus the United States. This is a case filed in New York by the ACLU on behalf of Edie Windsor, who, after caring for her spouse through years of multiple sclerosis, lost her spouse and then was handed a giant estate tax bill by the federal government that heterosexuals don't receive at one of the most painful times that she could experience that kind of treatment. We actually worked very closely with our sister groups in all three of these cases that coordinate about the experts that would be used in each case. And in fact, BLAG, the Bipartisan Legal Advisory Group, this is the entity that has come into each of these cases to defend DOMA, now that federal government will not, we got BLAG to agree that it would take one set of depositions of the experts and treat those depositions as if they've been taken for purposes of each case. And as it turns out, the expert testimony proved to be a very important part of the decision that we just received in Galinsky, so we are delighted that we were all able to work together with such good effect. In both Peterson and Windsor, briefing is complete, and there is not going to be a hearing in either case. In fact, Galinsky was the only one among these three to have a hearing before a federal trial judge. And I'll talk a little bit more about our hearing in a few moments. But because those cases are not waiting for a hearing, it does mean that a decision could come in those cases any day as well. Additionally, there is another DOMA challenge also pending in federal trial court in Northern California called Dragovich versus the United States Department of the Treasury. This case was brought by the Legal Aid Society Employment Law Center in the Bay Area on behalf of California employees who cannot purchase long-term care insurance for their spouses. The case is currently being briefed for summary judgment, which, as the lawyers on the call know, asks the court to render a final judgment in the case without a trial. The hearing will be held in April. Couple of interesting notes about this case. It does include claims on behalf of California State Registered Domestic Partners, who in fact they don't have a challenge directly against DOMA because they're not married, but they are seeking access to the same long-term care insurance that they could get if they could marry, because as we all know, while Perry, the challenge to Prop 8 is working its way through the courts, a significant number of couples in California are forced to rely on domestic partnership. So in this way, a case that seeks equal treatment for the couples who cannot marry, it's not unlike a case that Lambda Legal brought to the Ninth Circuit, which Leslie mentioned earlier, called Diaz v. Greer, which sought and thus far has won equal treatment for domestic partners in Arizona seeking domestic partner health benefits. So we hope that that work will help pave the way for similar victory in Dragovich as well. Then there are three challenges in the context of the military, at least three major ones I'm aware of. One was filed by the Veterans Legal Services Clinic at Yale Law School on behalf of a lesbian veteran denied spousal disability benefits. There's a second one filed by the Service Members Legal Defense Network in Massachusetts, so following in the footsteps of Gill v. OPM. And a third suit was recently filed by the Southern Poverty Law Center on behalf of a veteran denied the same disability benefits as heterosexual spouses. There is one feature that characterizes these cases, and also some areas of the law, but certainly these cases, having to do with unequal treatment of service members and veterans, and that is that DOMA is not always the only stumbling block to equal treatment. In some instances, there are other federal statutes or regulations that also specify that certain benefits can only be provided to heterosexual spouses. So this had left a sort of open question that a number of us were eagerly watching with bated breath. And that is, as folks may remember, this letter from Eric Holder to Congress a year ago, it took a position only as to DOMA. And it didn't take a position as to other laws, other regulations that might stand in the way of equal treatment for spouses. Well, we got the answer, at least in the military context, just last Friday, when Eric Holder sent a second letter to Congress explaining the approach that DOJ is going to be taking, and the approach in at least the military case that's the furthest along, is that they're going to treat those laws and the regulations that alongside DOMA deny equal treatment, they're going to treat them the same way. Those should be subjected to heightened constitutional scrutiny. The courts should presumptively look at them with great skepticism and treat them as discrimination that's very unlikely, justifiable by the government. And the federal government will also not be defending those discriminatory statutes and regulations in those cases. So we expect that BLAG is going to make good on its promise to come into those cases and mount a defense of the existing laws alongside DOMA. Okay, So that's an overview, as folks can tell. There's quite a lot going on. But let me go to Galinsky and just say a little bit about this really lovely decision that we got yesterday. And if folks haven't had a chance to read it, it's available on our website at lambdalegal.org. And Judge White did such a lovely job with this that I think it's really worth a read. So in Galinsky versus the Office of Personnel Management, we have the privilege of representing a really extraordinary client named Karen Galinsky, along with our excellent co-counsel at Morrison and Forrester. Karen has been fighting for equal spousal health coverage for her wife, Amy Cunningham, well, forever, it feels like sometimes. She's an employee of the Ninth Circuit. She's been with her spouse for over 20 years. She's been working for federal courts for over 20 years. She began seeking equal spousal health coverage through an administrative proceeding back in 2008. And as you can tell, it has taken this long to get a decision from a federal trial court. This case has really taken incredible perseverance on her part, and we are very honored to represent her and want to thank her for doing such an incredible service to the community through this case. So as I mentioned earlier, we had a hearing in this case in December. This case almost got to be broadcast. Some of you may remember some skirmishing about whether proceedings can be broadcast that happened when the trial of Proposition 8 was going to be done. That pilot program that was the subject of that controversy has now been put in place in the Northern District Court, and our judge had actually designated our case to be the first one to proceed with broadcasted proceedings under that program. But unfortunately, all parties have to consent, and not surprisingly, Blag would like to continue making these awful arguments about same-sex couples and DONA, under the cloak of secrecy and in the dark of the night. And so they objected to the broadcast, and that means that fewer people got to actually see and hear exactly what Blag is doing in terms of defending DONA using your taxpayer dollars in mind. But nonetheless, the transcript from the hearing is also available on our website, and it's definitely an illuminating read. So getting to the decision, I just want to say Judge White saw right through the arguments that Blag has been advancing. It's really worth noting, in addition to getting a ruling that Section 3 of DONA is unconstitutional, Judge White ruled that government discrimination against lesbians and gay men should be given heightened scrutiny, the concept I've been describing, meaning that the court should put the burden on the government to justify that unequal treatment, got to have a pretty good reason for it. And this is a hard burden to meet. This ruling, if it were to be upheld on appeal, could have monumental impact on all forms of anti-gay discrimination, and not only by the federal government, but also by state and local governments as well. So we're prepared to defend that victory vigorously, and we will see how it plays out. I have to say, Judge White really proved himself to be a master of nuance in this decision, properly analyzing the level of constitutional review that government discrimination should be given is quite intricate. And he, in his opinion, picked up a number of the nuances that we think are very significant, and we're absolutely thrilled now to have a published published federal court decision that adopts a number of these nuances in a way that we'll be able to leverage and use to try to persuade other courts in a whole range of work. Another takeaway from this decision that I want to mention is, this is definitely sort of a confirmation of something that we've believed for a long time, which is that building a record matters. We worked with several experts in this case to submit many pages of expert testimony, and the testimony was on the heightened scrutiny considerations the courts examine, and also on the purported government interest to support DOMA discrimination, including some of these tiny, awful arguments the other side always makes about same-sex parents not being equally good parents to their children. And so we had incredibly persuasive testimony from an expert on that point. And we also had expert testimony from next on the history of marriage who really helped drive home the point that DOMA's discrimination is really an unprecedented intrusion. And so the first time in the 230-plus year history of the country the federal government has intruded in this way on the province of the state, getting to say that a couple is validly married in four corners of that state. many of these experts incidentally worked with Camilla to provide testimony in her Barnum versus Bryan marriage equality case in Iowa, and then subsequently worked on the California federal challenge to Proposition 8. And so we've been delighted to be building on all of that work and to be using each piece of work as a really excellent foundation for the next steps to come after it. And I just want to say, Judge White relied on the testimony of each expert, and I think that was at least in part because there was a really striking contrast with Blagg's evidence, which was zilch. It was zero. They did not introduce a shred of admissible evidence. They used no experts, and instead relied on citations to online pop magazines and that sort of thing, which, not surprisingly, Judge White found completely unpersuasive. So I'll just say a couple of additional quick things and then turn things back over to Leslie and Camilla. The actual decision itself is a narrow one, at least at this stage. We had not asked the court for anything more than a narrow decision as to Karen, but the implications of the decision are actually much more significant, particularly they will be as the case goes up on appeal. And we do fully expect that there will be an appeal, and so we are preparing for it as I speak. Thanks so much. I'll leave it there.
Thank you very much, Tara. I've gotten two emails, just in case anybody thinks we're not really live, we really are, saying actually that the quality of the call is a little hard to hear. So I will just ask the three of us to not be on speaker phones if we can help it, and actually maybe turn the volume down a little bit on our mics. And I apologize if people are having a little trouble hearing, but we will try and make that better. So with thanks to Tara, I'm just going to turn the floor over to Camilla for another overview of relationship recognition and marriage equality activities around the country. Camilla?
Sure. Thanks, Leslie. And please do let me know, break in, if I'm either too loud or too soft or something else is wrong with the call. I just picked up. So I thought I would give folks an overview of what's going on outside of the DOMA context, the context that Tara has been addressing. The case that Tara won yesterday is a remarkable victory, and I echo her suggestion that people go and read it. She has really done an incredible job litigating that case, and it's going to create all sorts of momentum. Not just in California, not just with respect to DOMA challenges, but with respect to the steady march forward to marriage equality around the country. So it's a remarkable win, and we're extremely proud of it. I thought I would talk a little bit about the status of marriage nationwide. So what is the legal and political landscape? Because everything is moving so very quickly, it's hard to keep up. Even as we were jumping onto the call today, of course, we were chatting about Maryland, which was a victory only minutes before. So let's talk about what the status is for folks in different states. We now know that public opinion is moving very quickly in our favor, and not only do state legislatures tell us that, but for the first time in May of 2011, there was a Gallup poll that showed that majority public support exists now for the right to marry for same-sex couples. Now, we know that translating that into votes at a ballot box is a tougher question, but among 18 to 34-year-olds, who will be the future majority voting bloc, we now see support for marriage equality at 70%. So we have a lot to look forward to in terms of future victories, not just before legislatures or before judges, but even in votes as well. We have now won the freedom to marry in six states: Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, Vermont, New Hampshire, and New York, where same-sex couples presently may marry, as well as in the District of Columbia. And, of course, there have been recent exciting developments on that front in Washington, Maryland, and New Jersey, which I'll discuss in a moment. And there are also 18,000 same-sex couples who do remain validly married in California. So where are we now in terms of how many people will marry? Well, that's about 13% of all of the same-sex couples nationwide currently living in a jurisdiction in which they can marry today. And as Leslie mentioned, of course, Maryland today passed a marriage legislation. We know that Governor O'Malley has stated that he'll sign it. However, unfortunately, we do anticipate that that will be subject to a referendum. We also celebrated recently as we got a milestone victory in Washington after the state legislature there passed a marriage bill that was promptly signed into law by Governor Christine Gregoire. But again, our opponents have already filed what's called Referendum 74 to challenge that bill. In both cases, the referendum likely will prevent the law from taking effect prior to the election, so we're not likely to see married couples in either state prior to November. In New Jersey, we also recently saw the legislature pass marriage legislation, but unfortunately, Governor Christie vetoed that legislation. We have some time, however, to try to obtain enough votes to do a veto override, and we also have a case to watch there. Lambda Legal's New Jersey case under the state and federal constitutional guarantees of equality is now moving forward, and just this week, in fact, we got news that the trial court reinstated our federal equal protection claim in that case. So we've got momentum there as well. We have reason to be hopeful, too, that we are going to see success in a ballot measure that we ourselves, not we Lambda Legal, but the LGBT community has put on the ballot in Maine. They have decided that they have sufficient signatures, and so we have reason to hope that we will have a better result this time when marriage goes before the voters there. So in addition to the marriage laws that we have either seen develop or else we are looking forward to developing in the near future, we've also seen some advances in formal statuses like civil unions or domestic partnerships that provide the state law benefits, rights, and responsibilities associated with marriage, but under a lesser status, a lesser name, and without giving access to the status known as marriage under state law. So in 9 states now, we've got either through civil unions or broad domestic partnership laws an ability for same-sex couples to obtain legal recognition for their families. And we're now seeing also the Colorado legislature hotly debating a civil union bill that we have high hopes for as well. So there's great movement on that front too. So that's about half of American same-sex couples now living in jurisdictions where they can have their relationship legally recognized if you include those states that have a parallel scheme that relegates same-sex couples to something lesser than marriage, but that still provides them the state law benefits, rights, and responsibilities usually associated with that status. And I can't omit mention of the huge potential game changer that we all saw in a big victory recently in Perry versus Brown. The case that was brought by the Olson Boys legal team challenging the constitutionality of Proposition 8 in California. And as I'm sure most of the people on the call know, Proposition 8 is the ballot measure that prevented the state of California from issuing further marriage licenses in November of 2008. And that was a huge disappointment. It put an end to the issuance of marriage licenses in that state after a summer of love, after the victory of Lambda Legal and NCLR and the ACLU and the city of San Francisco before the High Court of California in a marriage equality case there. This victory before the Ninth Circuit in Proposition 8 was before a 3-judge panel, and the decision was 2-1, ruling that it was unconstitutional under the Federal Equal Protection Clause for the state of California to strip same-sex couples through this ballot measure of the right to marry after having previously determined that this was a fundamental guarantee of equality and of liberty under the state constitution. And in doing so, the Ninth Circuit, this opinion, cited a Lambda Legal case, Romer versus Evans, more than 2 dozen times, showing that it is important, as we've all recognized for many years, to create the building blocks to equality, to do work that helps not only bring us advances in the current case, but that helps to move us forward in future cases as well. And Romer versus Evans was a U.S. Supreme Court case that involved Amendment 2, an amendment in Colorado passed by the voters that rolls back non-discrimination protections that had been passed on a municipal level. And Amendment 2 was notorious for having been motivated by animus and for having prevented just lesbian and gay individuals from having any access to the protections that apply to everyone based on sexual orientation that prevented such discrimination. And the court referenced this important decision in saying that it was improper for the state of California to strip lesbian and gay individuals, similarly, of their right to marry alone. It's really a very eloquent opinion as well. And at times it's humorous. It quotes all sorts of popular culture references and Marilyn Monroe movies and all sorts of other things. So it's easy to read, and it's also very powerful. But it's important to recognize that the specific holding in this case was limited to the facts in California that involved the stripping away of a right to marry that was currently enjoyed by people in California. So the court specifically stopped short of considering whether the fundamental right to marry that applies to all of us throughout the nation was violated by Proposition 8, because it was unnecessary since it had ruled that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional on narrower grounds. Nevertheless, the language in the court's decision that spoke of the singular significance of the right to marry and the stigma and discrimination that was imposed not just upon same-sex couples but upon their children by the elimination of the right to access marriage for Californians is really remarkable, and I think will have strong resonance in days to come. Now, our opponents, this is, as I mentioned, a case that was brought by David Boies and Ted Olson, who are most well known for having been on opposite sides of the case Bush versus Gore, that we submitted an amicus brief that charted this theory that the majority of this panel before the Ninth Circuit found to be the winning theory. We had put in an amicus brief that charted this narrow way to victory because we felt very strongly that this was an important option to offer the court as a way for the court to hand down a victory that we felt was going to have longevity and that was likely to stand the test of time. The opponents, unfortunately, the proponents of Proposition 8, but our own opponents, have now already asked the Ninth Circuit to rehear the case en banc. And the Ninth Circuit has some sort of quirky rules that don't necessarily apply in other circuits. But if the Ninth Circuit decides to hear the case en banc, what that will mean is likely an 11-judge panel, so a panel including the chief judge plus 10 of the other Ninth Circuit judges will hear the case. Now, the Ninth Circuit doesn't have any specific amount of time that it imposes on itself for when it has to decide such a petition for rehearing, is my understanding. So it's unclear how long we'll have to wait before we know whether the court will hear the case en banc. Usually the court gives the plaintiffs an opportunity to respond, and so it's likely that the plaintiff's legal team will be able to submit something, and then we'll be in a waiting game to know whether the court decides to hear the Perry case again. And if it does, it could request briefing again, or it could just decide the case based on the briefs that are already before the court. So it's a little bit unclear how long the whole process will take if rehearing is granted, but it could be possibly about a year, which means that about this time next year we could be hearing the answer to the case on rehearing. And at that point, the parties who don't prevail in that process will have an opportunity to petition the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. And the U.S. Supreme Court does not have to grant certiorari. It doesn't have to agree to hear the case, but it may do so. So that's the Perry case. It could have very broad implications for the rest of the country, and it's an extremely exciting development. And if it continues to prevail, if the holding holds up, then the result will be that Californians who so wish to marry will be able to marry again in the near future. Now, even though we're excited about all of these developments and we're seeing a rash of states across the country where equality is becoming either something that people currently enjoy or something that seems to be within arm's reach, we can't stop fighting. And unfortunately, as Leslie mentioned, even after we've won the right to marry in a state, we sometimes see that our couples, our families are still subjected to incredible indignities and harms as their right to marry is disrespected in various contexts. And the Iowa cases, Gartner and Buntemeyer, are examples of that. Unlike every other state in the country, which has either permitted same-sex couples to marry or that has allowed same-sex couples to enter into civil unions or domestic partnerships, the state of Iowa denied the spousal presumption of parentage and the protections that it creates to children born to same-sex couples. And I'll just explain what the spousal presumption means. Historically, when a child has been born to a married couple, that child is presumed to be legally the child of both spouses. That means even if a different sex married couple gives birth as a result of reproductive technology, and the husband is not the sperm donor, they use anonymous donor sperm, or even if a wife gives birth as a result of infidelity to a child who is not genetically the husband's child, in every state there has been a spousal presumption of parentage that has required that child to be treated as the child of both spouses. In the other states in which same-sex couples have won the right to marry or have been able to enter into civil unions or domestic partnerships, the state immediately has treated children born to same-sex couples as legally the children of both spouses. That's been true even under Governor Romney in Massachusetts after Glad's victory in the Goodridge case in Massachusetts back in 2004 began causing marriage licenses to be issued there. So it's really striking that Iowa has chosen to disregard the right of children to be treated as having two parents at birth in reliance on the marriage of the parents. The Gartner family, unfortunately, applied for a birth certificate for a child born after they married, and the state issued them a birth certificate that listed only the birth mother on the birth certificate and did not list the name of the non-birthing mother. Now, a birth certificate, just like any other vital record, is supposed to document legal parentage. It doesn't have anything to do with biology, and as adopted children can attest, only the legal parents and not the genetic parents go on a birth certificate. And this is important because people use birth certificates in order to enroll children in school or to travel through airports or to pick up a lost child even from a police department. You need to be able to document that you are a legal parent and legally entitled to protect your child and to be responsible for your child. Well, the state has taken the position, unfortunately, that solely in the case of same-sex couples, birth certificates should track genetics, and that the spouse in a same-sex couple, unlike the spouse in a different sex couple, will not be treated as a legal parent and is not entitled to the spousal presumption of parentage. We filed a lawsuit on behalf of Heather and Melissa Gartner, on behalf of their child as well, Mackenzie Gartner, and we won in a trial court victory on January 4th of 2012. Unfortunately, a week later, the state issued a fetal death certificate for Jenny and Jessica Buntemeyer with respect to their stillborn son, Braden, who was born halfway through the third trimester of pregnancy, tragically after his umbilical cord had become wound around his neck and he was stillborn. The state whited out Jenny's name from the fetal death certificate, which is the sole official record of Braden's existence, and sent the fetal death certificate back to them with Jennifer's information eliminated from it. The way a fetal death certificate works is that it's basically a photocopy of the actual handwriting of the women who filled out the form at the funeral home, and then that photocopy is transferred onto an official form, and so that's how the department used whiteout to eliminate Jenny's name. So we have filed suit again on behalf of Jenny as well, seeking to have the spousal presumption of parentage apply to her to make sure that the state respects that it cannot white out a parent from a vital record like this, adding insult to injury to this grieving family. So there remains work to be done. Even as we seek marriage, we have to make sure that we remain vigilant to be certain that the spousal responsibilities and obligations and protections and rights and benefits continue to be applied equally, even after our victories, to same-sex couples who marry and also to their children. So these are just some of the developments going on nationwide. Of course, marriage is just a portion of what we do. We also do family law. We've seen some great victories lately in our advocacy on behalf of transgender people. I know that Tara has a case that's proceeding on behalf of a transgender individual. And we also have done a lot of work recently to shore up statuses like the domestic partnership statute that passed in Wisconsin, in which we've been successful so far in getting courts to uphold it against attack by our anti-gay opponents. And we've been very active in trying to combat some of the spurious claims of discrimination by those who argue that they should be able to discriminate against lesbian and gay individuals and couples based on their religious beliefs, both in the context of marriage and in other contexts as well. And so we'd be happy to talk about those efforts to fight back against our opponents with respect to these lines of attack too. So I think that's all I have for the introduction, Leslie. Is this an appropriate time to go for questions, or should we go into depth about any of these things further?
I think we should turn to questions. Thanks, Camilla, and thanks, Tara. Just to let the folks on the call know that we had planned for this call to go about an hour, so we have about 20 minutes remaining in the call, and we have gotten several questions during the call and a few in advance. So I will try to be the moderator and see if I can ask some of your questions. One question that came in, I'll try to ask in a general way with respect to respect the privacy of the person who asked it, but I think I'll ask you, Camilla, but certainly, Tara, you can jump in if you want to also answer. If a person has already been denied a federal benefit because of DOMA, let's say a Social Security claim or any other federal benefit, and then DOMA is subsequently struck down or repealed, is there any way that people can go back retroactively and seek the benefits that they felt they were entitled to?
That is a very context-specific question, and it may well depend on the context in which the benefit has been denied. So we would encourage people who are wondering whether they might be eligible to seek some sort of benefit that's been denied to them as a result of DOMA to call our help desk at 1-866-542-8336. And another reason why it's important to call, and to call sooner rather than later, is that you may be subject to requirements to, statutes of limitations, basically. You may be required, if you've been denied some sort of benefit, to take action in order to preserve your rights now. Otherwise, you may be considered to have sat on your rights, and you won't be able to seek some sort of compensation or whatever it is that you're looking for at a later date if you miss the opportunity just to make sure that you're putting in an appeal from a particular denial in a timely manner. So because these things are so context specific, we really want to work through them on an individual basis through our help desk staff. And what we may do is give you some advice on the call about what to do or what not to do, but we can also suggest that you contact some of our cooperating attorneys, and we have a wonderful network of LGBT-friendly attorneys around the nation, some of whom are specialists in tax areas and public benefits areas and other things, who can give you much more detailed suggestions too.
Thanks, Camilla. Tara, a question for you. Another caller is curious what you think is going to happen in the Galinsky case. I believe as you described it, so far we have won a wonderful victory that applies to our plaintiff and her particular eligibility for health care coverage. But what's going to happen next?
Well, so there's an interesting thread to that question. We have every reason to believe that Blagg and the federal defendants are going to appeal the decision. Interestingly enough, there are some parallels that could be, but probably won't be, with respect to this case and the Proposition 8 litigation, and you'll all see what I mean when I describe this. So Blagg, this five-member sort of advisory group that advises John Boehner, there are some serious questions in our mind, at least, about what kind of authority that group would have to do anything like take an appeal on its own. we had consented when they first approached us and had said that they would like to intervene in the case to present arguments about DOMA, and we consented to it because I do think that it's very important for public confidence in the process. For each of these major challenges to have a thorough, full airing so that, in fact, the victory feels that much more solid and strong because all views were aired and we still know there's no excuse for DOMA. But in terms of whether they can take steps like actually appeal, there are very serious questions in our mind about that. Nonetheless, the federal defendants, the federal government generally has said that it is going to be taking the steps necessary to ensure that BRAG can present its positions and its defense of DOMA at various stages of litigation. So we actually expect that both BRAG and the federal defendants, even though they're represented by DOJ, which agrees that DOMA is unconstitutional, we expect that all of those parties will file a notice of appeal. They have 60 days to do so, and we don't have any insight into how long they're actually going to take, but then the case will proceed from there to the Ninth Circuit.
And the big picture that the caller is also asking is, do we think that either our case or the other cases you described, Tara, will all wind up at the Supreme Court or may never wind up at the Supreme Court? What's likely to happen in the long run?
Well, great question. And actually, because it is so hard to predict which of any one of these or several of them may go to the Supreme Court, I think, as Camilla mentioned, Supreme Court generally has discretion over the petitions for certiorari that it grants, and so it may or may not choose to hear any number of these. That's actually one of the reasons that we and our sister groups have felt so strongly that for any of these challenges over which we have, you know, some amount of control and ability to really affect the presentation of the case, that's why we have felt it as strongly that it's important for each of these cases to have a fulsome record developed in the trial court, since we actually don't know which one might be the one the Supreme Court would grant review to. And this way we help ensure, we hope, that whichever case it is to go to the Supreme Court, it's going to be one where the issues have been so thoroughly vetted at the trial court level that we can have full confidence that the Supreme Court will have everything in front of it that it might need to decide the issues.
Thank you. I'll turn to you, Camilla, with a question. One of our callers wants to know whether the speculation in the press that some of the LGBT leaders and advocates don't want a challenge to go to the Supreme Court but would rather have a state-by-state strategy, do we have an opinion on the pros and cons of the strategy of cases going to the Supreme Court, or are we doing the work on a state-by-state basis?
Well, it's the legal groups, actually, who filed the challenges to DOMA, starting with GLAAD, as Tara mentioned, who filed the initial challenge to DOMA in federal court in Massachusetts. And then, of course, the Galinsky case is our case, and the ACLU has also filed a case in the Second Circuit as well. And I think everybody anticipates that these DOMA cases will get to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's sort of interesting. We're winning in all of them, it seems. So the thought that a circuit split might make it more likely is an interesting theoretical question, but it does seem inevitable that the U.S. Supreme Court will be hearing a DOMA challenge, and probably before very long as well. And we have a lot of optimism for these challenges, and the fact that the federal government, through the Department of Justice itself, has determined that this law is indefensible and should not stand, I think is an indication of the progress we've made both in court and out of court over the last few years. And it's important to note with the DOMA challenges, the result would be that the federal government must respect determinations by states of the eligibility of same-sex couples to marry, so that historically the federal government has always deferred to state determinations of who may marry. Of course, it's subject to the federal floor of the U.S. constitutional guarantees of equality and of liberty. But the federal government, through DOMA, has enacted discrimination in a way that's completely novel. The results from these DOMA challenges, though, would not mandate that same-sex couples be entitled to marry in states that have marriage bans on the books. So in many ways, it's a much more limited request than the Terry case, which has potentially broad implications. There are certainly very broad ways to answer the claims that are made by the plaintiffs in the Perry case. Plaintiffs in the Perry case have made a liberty claim, for example. They have argued that the constitutional right to marry, the freedom to marry that's guaranteed in the Due Process Clause of the Federal Constitution, has been infringed by Proposition 8. And certainly, if the U.S. Supreme Court were to agree with that claim, then that would have implications for marriage bans around the country. So it's important, I think, to give the U.S. Supreme Court a selection of opportunities to rule, to make sure that there are ways that could appeal to every member of the court, so that if certain members of the court don't feel ready to reach for the broadest possible implication, that there are other ways that they can feel comfortable ruling that will still advance our march toward equality. And I think that those opportunities are available in the Perry case, and we're, you know, obviously very excited to continue to participate through our amicus briefing, and to continue to make sure that every possible avenue for relief is illustrated for the court as it goes up, and I think we'll win.
So there's a follow-up question to that. One of the callers is curious that when we get to the point, and we're feeling optimistic that we're getting there, that we have one marriage equality in many states, but we have the list left of states where there are state constitutional amendments, mini-domas as we sometimes call them. What's the legal strategy, or perhaps the legislative advocacy strategy, to deal with those states?
Well, I guess perhaps I should have clarified also with respect to the previous question that I don't view one strategy as being important to the exclusion of all others. So even while we proceed to take down DOMA, and even while we work our best to make sure that cases like Perry succeed, we still have to continue working at the state level as well. Not just because these victories that we win state by state, both in the courts and in the legislature, are important to keep our momentum going, but they're also great vehicles for telling our stories. And I think that the reason why we've seen so much momentum in the last few years and why we're being so successful is because of the visibility of lesbian and gay couples and their children. And these families coming out and telling their stories and living their lives as who they are, unafraid and proud to be part of the struggle and just proud to be visible. That's what's changing people's minds. That's what's communicating that these families deserve equal dignity, because people are suddenly realizing that lesbian and gay couples and their children are everywhere. So I do think it is important that we continue to work state by state, and we continue to work even on a more local level than that. Our grassroots efforts can't falter either. Even as we work at the very top levels in court to try to take down DOMA and to try to move the affirmative law forward with respect to marriage equality under federal constitutional principles. Now, there may come a day, depending on how the U.S. Supreme Court rules and how quickly it embraces full equality, that we will have to work to take off anti-gay constitutional amendments from state constitutions. We may have to vote them out, and I think we're going to see some developments this year that will give us a clue of how quickly that can occur. We're seeing anti-gay constitutional amendments go to the ballot in North Carolina and in Minnesota. And as I mentioned earlier, we're also seeing a positive development in Maine as pro-equality activists seek marriage at the ballot there. And the polling numbers actually look pretty good in Maine and Minnesota. I think we've got a great chance. We've got great coalitions in place in these states. And that day won't be too far off when we do start to win at the ballot and when we do find ourselves in a position where we are voting these constitutional amendments off And I know it may seem like a very long time in the future, particularly for people who are living in certain states where we're seeing a lot of anti-gay activity and states where these marriage amendments passed with very large margins originally. And as an Ohio native, I can understand that feeling. But it won't be long. The speed of change that we've seen in recent years is so great that I'm very hopeful that we will see that day just in a few years.
Thanks. So we're at about a little bit less than 5 minutes before the hour, so I'm just going to say a few final thoughts of my own and then check in with Camilla and Tara to see if you have any final thoughts. My final thought is just that it's an incredibly exciting moment in our history and in our movement. Lambda Legal is an incredibly exciting place to work, and it's great to work with all our sister organizations across the country. And I'm very proud of the legal and the advocacy work that we do here, and very proud of how many supporters and friends we have all around the country that are part of our work by being members and donors. So it's pretty exciting. It's exhausting, and it's wonderful. But, of course, we have so much more to do because there are so many states where we haven't won the battles yet, whether it's marriage equality or other equally important battles about non-discrimination in the workplace, in schools, in healthcare, and so on. So exciting time, and thank you all so much for being part of it. Tara or Camilla, do you have any final thoughts before we sign off?
I'm sorry, I talked too much.
This is Tara. I have to say quickly that I just want to thank everyone so much for supporting the work. It's an honor and a privilege to do it, and we take so seriously the idea that when we're doing cases that involve the rights of many people, we have a public trust, and it's one that we have to honor by doing the absolute best possible work. We work very hard to do it, but we're also really inspired by the people who are our supporters and lead us to want to do the best possible work we can do for them. So I would thank everyone on this call for contributing to that. We really are appreciated, and we're so happy to do the work for each and every one of us.
Okay, well, thank you. And if we didn't get to your question, we will try to respond to it by email and get back to you. And once again, thanks to our speakers, Camilla and Tara, and thanks to everybody for calling in. And our call is concluded. Good night.